Hey, and welcome to the Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. Today's sponsor, Hearst Ranch. Hearst Ranch is the largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. Since 1865, the Hearst family has raised cattle on the rich, sustainable, native grasslands of the Central California coast. The result is beef with extraordinary flavor that's as memorable and natural as the surrounding landscape. More info, go to HearstRanch.com. I just wanted to mention, Jack, this is the 50th episode of The Food Scene.
Congratulations.
Oh, I thought you were going to push a button to make some kind of like cheer effect. But I don't think we're that advanced yet. Oh, there we go. We actually had one. Fantastic. Actually, only this will be the 48th aired. We have two in our back pocket coming up, Bumpus and Parr, Jellymongers, as well as Lota, Jan's daughter, wonderful Brooklyn designer, to be aired next month. But today on The Food Scene, lucky enough to have a great collection of artists brought to us. Well, I was pointed in their direction initially by Amy Gilbert of the Umami Festival, a prior guest on the show, Tat Food Tan, Michael Privich, and Jorge Rojas. Jorge, are you on the line? Nope, I don't think he's on the line yet, but we'll get him soon. So these artists work in a whole bunch of different mediums, but we're all together recently at Project Row Houses, which is kind of an artist collaborative down in Houston, Texas, but I think it'd be easier for either Tat Food or Michael to explain more. Project Row Houses, can you tell us a little bit about, you know, the layout of the land?
Michael, you want to go?
Sure. Project Row Houses was started in 1993. The way I understand it is artists took over some neglected houses in a neighborhood in Ward 3 in Houston. It's a neighborhood that's mostly African American. It's on the edge of downtown Houston. The way I understood it, the city was going to level a number of these, they're called shotgun houses or row houses. So a number of artists took them over with the idea of having a place to work and live, I think. I'm not so sure about
and
them.
And you were explaining they're like one-story houses, and there were about a collection of about 50.
Yeah, they now have, I think, 48 is what I heard. I think they're about 700 square feet, galvanized tin roofs, typical worker housing, front door, back door, like an open layout. Seven or eight of these houses are now exhibition spaces, and they have a rigorous artist exhibition program that is part of Project Row Houses. And included in the exhibition program is housing that they provide, low-income housing, housing for young mothers. I don't know how that all works, but it works really well.
So it's not just for visiting artists, it's for the community to live in as
very
well.
Very vital. Yeah. That's the thing about it. It's a very, very active and vital community. And when artists are invited in, it's a residency. We were there for about 10 days. We were given a place to live. And part of the premise of our being there and making art was also interacting with the community. And it was done in a kind of formal, organized way, and also much informality. But they do have a set structure for artists to work in the community there, which is what I was saying when we met a few minutes ago. It's just a fantastic place to work because of the exchange with people. And they model it on some level on the social sculpture program of Joseph Beuys, where art is... everyday activities can be elevated to art. So Project Row Houses has this high-minded or community-minded as you want to be, which is what's really incredible about it.
Excellent. Actually, we have Jorge on the line too right now, right? Hi, Jorge.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Good, all right, good. Jorge.
Where are you right now?
I'm actually in Salt Lake City, Utah.
Excellent, excellent. Are you getting some good weather at the moment as well?
No, it was just hailing really hard here.
I'm sorry to rub it in, but we're having like our first spring summer day of the season, and we're loving it.
Oh, I'm happy for you. You guys deserve it. I was living in Brooklyn for the last 6 years up until recently, so I'm happy that you guys are getting some nice weather.
Excellent. I kind of wanted to talk to all three of you about how you were approached by Project Row Houses or how you found yourself there. And since we got Jorge on the line right now, I was wondering how you were brought into that community.
Absolutely. I met Ashley Klemmer Hoffman and Linda Shearer about 2 years ago through the National Performance Network. They have a program called the Visual Artist Network that we all belong to, and Project Row Houses is one of the partners in that project. And so that's how we met, and we've just become friends and stayed in touch for a long time. And I went out to Project Row Houses about a year ago just to check it out and become familiarized with the neighborhood and learn more about the project, and I just fell in love with it. And I guess it was just last winter when I met Ashley again and Linda at the conference for the National Performance Network, and they told me that they were thinking about doing a show around the topic of food. And I said, well, you know, I just, I'm working on a project right now called the Tortilla Oracle, where I read people's tortillas. And she was like, what? You got to talk more about that. And so that's how the conversation started specifically for this project. And we stayed in touch. When they started putting the show together, I sent them a proposal along with a couple of other components to the show that accompanied the performance element, and I was fortunate enough to get invited to go and be part of this show.
Fantastic.
And to meet Michael and Tetsu and another amazing group of artists.
Yeah, it seemed like quite a spectrum of performing arts as well. I mean, you mentioned that you're reading people's fortunes on tortillas. We'll get back to that because I think it needs a little bit of explanation. But Michael was working on a project more directly related to the sugar trade. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. My contribution to the show's called A Matter of Food, and my contribution was called Sugarland. And 2 years ago, my wife was in an artist residency in the Dominican Republic, and I went to visit her a couple of times, and unbeknownst to me, the Dominican Republic has large sugarcane fields, and they were harvesting right in the area where we were staying. And I became fascinated by it because of the scale of the sugarcane and the methods used to harvest it. And they were the work was done completely by Haitian laborers that had come over from Haiti. And the Dominican Republic and Haiti share the island of Hispaniola.
Yeah.
So I grew up in California, the Central Valley, an agricultural place.
Yeah.
And I'm used to seeing farm workers and agriculture, but I'd never seen anything quite like this because it was completely just hardcore, tough conditions.
Yeah. So, I mean, it wasn't like $60 a day laborers getting
picked
up.
No, they're hand harvesting with machetes, yeah, these fields that you could see for miles that go to the horizon. You know, I didn't understand why it was so primitive and why the Haitians were so isolated. There's a great deal of racism in the Dominican Republic towards Haitians, which is a long history, and that's what I spent the last couple of years learning about. The Haitians live separately in communities called Batés, and all of that was a very long period where I was just learning out why I saw what I saw. And I've been making art about that subject the last couple of years, about Haiti and the Dominican Republic. And the show in Houston is kind of the result of a lot of that research, where I'm showing sugarcane in a isolated setting and referencing the Houston area. As it turns out, is a former sugar producing area. There's a large company, a corporation called Imperial Sugar.
Yeah.
A likely name. So I used that. I referenced it quite a lot in my exhibition. The Imperial Sugar Company is a conglomerate, and they get sugar from all over the world, including the Dominican Republic. And my point with the show is that we have cheap available sugar in America, but it's at a price of people that we don't necessarily see.
Yeah.
So that was kind of what my contribution was about, was that subject and how we are very fortunate to have what we have, but people pay the price for it.
Yeah. I mean, all of you and Project Row Houses itself kind of work around these societal systems, but what you guys are pointing out is that food systems and society are, you know, in hand. And a lot of Tatfu's work deals with that specifically. Could you tell us a little bit about your SOS project?
Yeah.
SOS project is my own project that I started here in New York for a few years already, and Project Roadhouse approached me to show it at their space to be a catalyst so that their own greenhouse initiative could be activated a little bit more better. And since I'm there, I managed to meet my fellow artist and exhibitor, Chef Tasha, who is just having a great, amazing community garden just a block away, but they, these two kind of entity never really get a chance to meet and to interact a little bit better. But since I'm there, I managed to kind of get them to meet, and maybe hopefully in the long run they would be able to work together.
Is that the Eco Team?
Eco Tone Community Garden. Yeah, and that's the purpose of me being there, using art to activate the community itself. And a lot of people think that you know, gardening and things is only for people that has money, but actually the poor people, the people that has low income, need it the most.
I mean, most people that worked in agrarian societies were, you know, the poorest, were the ones that worked for the wealthiest, but were in the fields actually dealing with the food. So
just the provider class, working class. Yeah. Sure.
So is there that big disconnect down there? I mean, who was accessing the community garden before you were there?
It's not just there, it's everywhere. People still think that the trend of a community garden or the green movement is something that, you know, people that well do, you know. It's not for people that are, you know, poor because they couldn't afford it. But it's more like taking back the land, doing something for yourself, not waiting for someone else to rescue you.
Yeah.
Not waiting for government to change the rules, but, you know, to go ahead and use your hand and be clever what you put into your body.
Yeah.
And trust the land rather than trust the label.
Yeah.
Those kind of ideas should manifest itself a little bit more.
Yeah.
So, hopefully the shows and what Chef Tasha and the Greenhouse Collective doing locally there, you know, will make an impact in the community, because Project Roadhouse itself has its own built-in community. People actually live there. So
yeah,
it's really great that these people are doing things there.
So outside of the community that lives there, what kind of demographic did you see come into Project Roadhouse? This is a question for all of you, Jorge as well.
Jorge?
Do you guys want to take that?
Well, it's certainly heavily embedded in the African American neighborhood that's right there. That's the dominant community that uses Project Roadhouse. But the cool part, I thought, was just how, in addition to that, Rice University Architecture School kept coming. They were bringing their classes in, which is mostly a white student body, it looked like, now that I think about it. And the University of Houston as well. They're also right down the street from Project Roadhouse. So the organizers of Project Roadhouse are working hard to bring other communities in and mix it up. And it's a very favorable place to do that, because it's set up, there's so much space, and there's so many opportunities to mix up with artists, with the Project Roadhouse staff and the people that participate. It's a very welcoming, interesting community.
And, I mean, the title of this collaborative piece was Matter of Taste. When you first...
Matter of Food, sorry.
Mm-hmm. And when you first went into Project Roadhouse, did you see a certain kind of eating structure with the residents of those houses? Did you see, you know, some kind of food system that they were using? Like, were they eating healthy food? Were they eating local food? Or was this the first time they were privy to the idea of...
We need Ashley here for this one.
Yeah, but that's no...
I think one of the challenges that that the community there in the Third Ward is faced with is that there's not a lot of local organic stores or healthy restaurants or, you know, those kinds of options. And so I think that they're really trying to create ways for those kind of things to be developed locally so that they're not having to go far away to get healthy food. And so I think there's a spirit of healthy living overall at Project Roadhouses, and in that community is the sense that I got. But I think that there's a lot of room for and I know that they're trying to do so to do stuff locally and in the neighborhood to create a better healthier eating environment.
Yeah.
Yeah, certainly. Like we were talking before, the community is economically segregated from the rest of Houston. So it has a long way to go up to change that, to improve that. And I think what Tatfu was talking about contributes tremendously. Ecotone Garden is a step of how to do that. There's a long way to go, but I think this is a good way to get there.
One simple example is that the last night we've been trying to cook stuff in our space that we've been living together, and in the fridge is just very limited stuff that we bought in a supermarket, and we were too lazy to go out, so we just scratch around the whole neighborhood in project grow houses. Since Greenhouse Collective has planted stuff there, so we managed to eat healthy, fresh, and have fresh eggs and fresh vegetables off the ground, and cook a delicious meal that we really enjoy, because we didn't have a recipe, we just cook whatever that's available.
Yeah,
and it's a fellowship among us, and the good ingredients and the creativeness how to cook that dish out that makes the whole experience so much memorable.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Mm-hmm. We're going to take a quick, well, go ahead, Jorge.
Well, I was just going to add to that and just say that I know that one of the initiatives that they're exploring is to creating a local market. Mm-hmm. It will be, based in the neighborhood and using organic products. And so I know that that's an initiative that they're really working on doing the Project Grow House, which I think is great.
Yeah, because, I mean, after the show just recently closed, correct?
No, it's up until June 19th.
Oh, excellent. So
Juneteenth.
Head down to Houston, check out Project Grow House's Matter of Food. We're going to take a quick break and talk about, because what's fantastic, what's kind of amazing is the array of backgrounds that you all come from, and then you found this common place to be able to project this similar ideal. Next on The Food Scene. We'll be right back.
Public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Tune in to The Naturalist every Monday at 12 p.m. Bernie Wides, a.k.a. The Naturalist, is a walking encyclopedia of history, biology, geography, and a whole host of other words ending in Y. The Naturalist is his platform to make you just a little bit smarter every week, covering an enormous breadth of topics from animal life to prehistoric New York. Let Bernie's dulcet voice and razor-sharp intellect guide you through 30 minutes of pure, unadulterated knowledge. Co-hosted by Carol Butler. Again, that's every Monday at 12 p.m. on the Heritage Radio Network.
Welcome back to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. Here today with Tatfu Tan, Michael Pribich, Jorge Rojas, all contributing artists to the Project Grow House's Matter of Food exhibition. They're artists in their own right, too, and come from a whole bunch of different backgrounds, and I kind of wanted to explore that, starting with Tatfu. Because a lot of your art, as stated in a couple of your artist statements themselves, deals with how art practices to, you know, explore a way how individuals in society are kind of like collapse these different ideas, art, life, food, that, you know, everything's kind of intertwined. When did you kind of realize that in your artistic career, that, you know, you didn't have to have this singular focus about a project, that it can incorporate a lot more?
I used to be a painter, and then I was showing in galleries and stuff, but I felt some sort of of failure in my part being an artist, because I just do one type of media that stuck onto a wall, and,
yeah.
and I couldn't get out of that, and it has to be protected and being cared for. So I decided to change my practice a little bit, so become social sculpture, where I interact with people and change people's perception. I want to make my art more useful in some way, make sense, and put it in an experience. When people interact with my art, they bring back an experience from that whole interaction, and they will feel empowered that they could do the same thing. A lot of my artwork is being designed so that normal people, the public, can access it either on my website or from instructional pieces that I give out, so that people are more empowered and they felt that their life is being enriched by art.
Yeah. You know, I love the term that I've seen written about you, shared experience, because, you know, sharing is a thing that you give on to another, like a mentorship.
Right.
And it's not just you're in the same place as the person at the same time. You're actually giving something of yourself and of your art to another person. I just find that, you know, kind of spectacular in this day and age sometimes.
Yeah, it is a gift.
Yeah.
You know? And without sharing, you can't really... It's just one-sided, you know. Just like love, like life itself, you need to be shared. Just like food, it tastes better when it's shared among people.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah.
And food itself is so powerful because food, like the language or the syllabus of the universe. When you meet some nice girl, the first thing you invite her for dinner. You know, there's a celebration, you want to host a dinner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it is the best thing, medium to play around with.
It is a fantastic medium. Talking about like sharing experiences, I wanted to talk a little bit about your Cuisine du Jour project.
Mm.
Because I think that's in direct reference to what you did down in Project Row Houses. In Cuisine du Jour, and tell me if I'm incorrect, you had immigrant families or kind of share their immigrant food experiences. This was at the Tenement Museum?
And the Tenement Museum. And they bring in a piece of memento that they photograph and put into a jar and being pickled in a jar. So basically try to preserve a memory that they have from where they come from. But as we all know, the more we go to a new place, the more we forgot about the old place that we were. So we were trying to preserve something that might not be able to preserve itself. And it works perfectly because on the Lower East Side, it is the mecca of pickling.
Yeah.
So from there, the inspiration just came.
Yeah, yeah. So did you have cravings every once in a while for half sour during the project and go around the corner to the pickle guys?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. What's so cool about that is, you know, it wasn't any one specific immigrant, you know, sect. You were getting people from all over the world, right? Mm,
yes. Yeah, all over the place, Latin America, Europe, everywhere. And it's about, you know, especially in New York, we are so used to food, international food, that we don't even realize that, you know, we go out and we eat so much different things. And it actually embed in our psyche that we learn a lot from various cultures itself also.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also relate to immigrants, I want to bring back another project called Share a Prayer.
Yeah.
It's because of that I've been invited to Queens Museum, and they have this piece of antique document coming back to the museum. It's called a Flushing Remonstrant, 300 years old document that kind of is the DNA for our religious freedom that we enjoy here in America.
Mm-hmm.
And they asked contemporary artists to reinterpret what religious freedom is in Flushing right now. And I went to various religious sites to acquire various prayer requests, but it's in the form of an adhesive sticker that I bring back to the museum and place it into a vending machine. So when the kids or anyone that who buy a soda or a snack from the vending machine, they are given the snack itself that has a piece of sticker onto it. The sticker, you might not be able to read it because it might be in foreign languages, in other scripts that you might not understand, but you know that you are living among different people, even though you don't understand who they are or their behavior. You should respect, you know, their religious freedom and who they are itself. So from that project is very interesting to me also.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. No, and again, the shared experience that there is that true respect for another culture that you don't necessarily understand, which kind of leads me to Jorge's Gente de Maize. Would you consider that people of the corn? Is that a good interpretation, Jorge? Uh-oh, did we lose Jorge?
Jorge?
We might have lost. Yeah, we might have lost him. We'll come back to that. Yeah, Jorge?
I'm here.
Oh, excellent. There you are. We were just chatting a little bit with Tapfu about shared experience and about, you know, dealing with a whole bunch of cultures that you might not understand, but you should respect. And it kind of led me to your project, the Gente de Maíz, the people of the corn. And it was, you know, based on the idea of what? That people worship corn and maize for all these good things. You know, and you made these pieces. You made, corn people. You made miniature corn people. You invited guests to illustrate hopes and wishes on dried corn husks and then read their fortune therewith. And then you also created an altar where tortillas are prepared and read in a divining ceremony. Is that correct?
That's all correct, yes.
Excellent. I did a little bit of research. but what's fantastic is that, you know, corn, I think, is really taken for granted in the U.S., across the world. But it was never taken for granted in the project that you did. I mean, it was a thing of worship. How did you arrive at this idea?
Good. I'm originally from Mexico. So corn for the native cultures of the Americas, including the Aztecs and the Maya and the Native American Indians, is a very spiritual, important thing. Cultures all throughout the Americas have worshipped corn, maíz, as we call it, as this deity of plenty. It represents fertility, and it's often linked with like renewal of life and protection. So it's something that we have a deep history with. And so I just wanted to explore some of these myths and some of these legends surrounding corn and maíz. And also I'm interested in mystical practices.
Yeah.
A lot of my work deals with like communication systems and social structures, communities, and so there's a lot of performance-based stuff, ritual, and also bringing people together. So a lot of participatory types of projects, and so so that's kind of how I became interested in that. I was also reading a book around that time that was recommended to me called Men of Maíz, which is, or Hombres de Maíz, as it is in Spanish, by an author named Miguel Ángel Asturias. He actually was the winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature back in, like, 68. Mm. And the whole book talks about this sort of this myth or this idea that the Mayans had that their flesh was actually made of corn, as if, you know, they had come from corn. And there's a lot of legends around in the Maya and in Aztec folklore that talk about our connection to corn. And so I just wanted to take some of these myths and sort of reinterpret them in my own way and create these projects that would involve the community and that would bring us all together in building this. So there was the after-school program. There were lots of kids that were coming by almost every day throughout my stay there that were coming and helping me build this village of little corn people. Yeah. So each one is handmade, made out of corn tortilla flour, like masa.
Yeah.
Just mixed with water, so it's basically kind of like Play-Doh. And then every kid and also the single mothers group at Project Row Houses and other artists and just people come by and help me build this little kind of a village that was hundreds and hundreds of little corn people.
I know. I was about to say, you said little, even though they were mini corn people, they surely weren't little corn people. I mean, it was a massive structure of, like you said, hundreds and hundreds.
Mm-hmm.
But what was the shape that they were all set in?
The shape that they were set in?
Yeah. It kind of looked like, you know, big concentric circles.
Yes, that's right. Well, it was a section of the project house where I was given to work in, and it had this perfect kind of size for what I was trying to accomplish. I built this this corn mandala, mm-hmm. with, you know, there's a different color of corn. There's the blue and the red and the yellow and which also has some symbolism behind it. So I built this mandala in the center of it, and then all of the corn people were kind of coming towards it and from it. sort of is going back to this idea that they come from corn, but it's also something that they worship. So it was these concentric circles all around this colorful corn mandala.
Excellent. And the second part of that project was the writing your hopes and wishes on the corn husks. So the participatory part was the actual writing.
Yeah, and that really just came from the idea that basically corn husks were used. In my research, I found out that people would use corn husks as these things of good luck and protection. And so, like, for instance, over a baby's crib, Indians would put corn husks over the crib to protect the child from evil spirits, or over their front doorways. Hmm. So I thought, how nice to create this sort of like this prayer wall, you taking some of the influences from different cultures and letting people just kind of in the community and that are visiting the exhibition come and write down their hopes, their wishes, their dreams, things that they, you know, positive thoughts. And with time, it's basically kind of turned into this big curtain of these beautiful dried corn husks. All with, putting together this prayer wall.
I'm assuming, too, that you had peoples from many different cultures writing their hopes and dreams. Because I always find it fascinating when someone interacts with an exhibition like that and isn't necessarily from that culture, how open they are to venting or to, you know, putting that faith into a project. But it shows that trust that we were talking about before, or that respect for different cultures. Mm-hmm. And I've always found that fascinating. But I don't want to gloss over the tortilla oracle, because every once in a while I'm eating tortillas, I think I see something too. And I want to know what this is all about.
and I'm really happy to talk about that. That kind of was the genesis of this whole project for me, and it has a little bit of a history. Actually, the first Tortilla Oracle performance that I did was in Bushwick, in Brooklyn, when I was living there just about a year ago at this place called the St. Nick's Alliance Community Arts Space there in Brooklyn. But I've been reading tarot cards for over, I don't know, 20 years. And it's just something that I love to share with my friends and with my family. And I've just always been interested in the, in the mystical. Food is a very important thing for me as a Mexican, and also with my immediate family, my wife and my child. We love having dinner parties, and it all kind of started out just kind of as a tongue-in-cheek thing, where we're all hanging around the kitchen and we're making quesadillas or something, and we started noticing these marks in the tortilla, and we just started playing around with the idea, like, look, you know, I see love in your future, or I think I see the Virgin of Guadalupe on there, or just kind of, you know, playing with this thing of like these visions that come to people where they see like Christ on a piece of toast or something like that.
Yeah.
But it was kind of started out tongue in cheek, and then when I first did the performance, I decided that I wanted to play with this concept and take it further and really kind of explore this idea of how people interact and then people's faith and believe in things. So it's sort of like a metaphor of how we see life or how we see art even. You know, if you go with an open mind into a space and you're there to learn and you're there to experience something new, then you're probably going to get something out of the art that you experience there, and, you know, and such is life as well. And so I think the same thing goes for these type of mystical practices. If you go in with an open heart and an open mind, then you're probably going to get something out of the reading. So I realized very early on in this process that people were coming in, they weren't really thinking of it as a performance. I was, they weren't. They were coming in and really wanting to get something out of it, to take some wisdom, or, you know, people were asking me about their love lives, about their businesses, about their intimate things, and so I thought, well, why not just put all my heart and soul into this and really just, you know, try to offer something positive and beautiful, and so, you know, people ask me, well, is it real? Well, I think it's real, and I put all my best energy into it, and I do feel like I am offering some kind of information that's positive and that's helpful. And a lot of times people have come back to me and they say, Jorge, the reading was amazing, everything you told me was right on, everything that you know, and people have even come back to me on Facebook saying, can I read their tortillas, can I read the tortillas over the phone?
Do you get tortillas sent to you in the mail
sometimes?
It's kind
of an interesting process of how it started and what it's become. And so I really see it as this
as a performance piece, but I also see it as an opportunity to have the audience become an active participant in the artwork itself.
Yeah. Hmm. No, I mean, it shows how much faith people have, though, in those kind of practices, in allowing art to interpret good thoughts. Mm-hmm. You know, rarely do you see people walk into an environment where they know they're going to get bad news from whatever reading or whatever source. Mm-hmm. But they're very willing and accepting of good news. And what you guys are spreading through Project Row Houses and, you know, your own projects are things of good faith or, you know, good ideas. And I hope you find willing participants and, you know, open ears for a lot of this. Are there any new projects that you're all working on right now that, you know, you'd like to tell us about?
Sure. I'd like to tell about an SOS Guilds, where I actually sponsoring artists. I became my own micro grant program. I save up $500 in a year, and I like to pay it forward to someone, another artist who uses art as a tool for sustainability, something that I do and passionate about. So I think that in this economy, which is like everything is with bad news, I wanted to do something more positive. And so that's my next initiative. And I'm also going to host a dinner that is organized by MAPP, and it's going to be around a theme of interdependency. And it's being, I think I was inspired by our dinner with Michael and Esperanza, Michael's wife, that we cook with limited resources. And I wanted, in the dinner, I'll invite all the different guests to come to the dinner with only one ingredient, and they could only cook from those limited choices. And by doing that, they have to talk to each other, discuss what could be made, and brainstorm a little bit, and cook a dish out and enjoy together.
Yeah.
So that will be the next project.
A true melting pot.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, I really appreciate all you taking your time, not only for the show, but to create such wondrous ideas and, you know, pay it forwards, as Tatfu said. Jorge, thank you.
Thank you so much for having us, and a big shout out to Project Row Houses for hosting this event, because they're the ones that are, I think, they're really doing amazing things over there. So anyone that's interested in social sculpture, community building, social justice, any type of art around that, should really look into Project Row Houses.
Excellent, and that shows up till Juneteenth.
They call it June 19th.
Juneteenth. Head down to Houston, Texas, or if you're already there, stop by Project Row Houses. Michael Pribich, Tatfu Tan, Jorge Rojas, thank you all again. All right. Been listening to The Food Scene on heritageradionetwork.com. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, hoping to be back here next Tuesday at 3 p.m. Thank you to Jack Inslee for making this studio run, Hearst Ranch for sponsoring, and this wonderful weather for finally arriving. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. In 2010, EscapeMaker.com won an Emmy Award for their agritourism webisode, so this year they thought, why not bring agritourism and green getaway ideas right to you? Come to the Green Getaways Local Food and Travel Expo on April 30th at One Hanson Place, home of the Brooklyn Flea and former Williamsburg Savings Bank. Presented by Amtrak, Zipcar, and I Love New York, the carbon-free event will be a day filled with food, prizes, workshops, and kids' activities. Over 50 getaway destinations, from counties to local farms and bed and breakfasts within a day's drive or train ride of New York City, will be exhibiting on the main floor and in the huge bank vault downstairs. See what's hot in sustainable travel and receive special show-only discounts. Grow NYC will be doing workshops on the Green Market, and Appalachian Mountain Club will offer workshops on adventure bicycling and hiking via mass transit. EscapeMaker.com will be giving away over 50 getaway prizes, ranging from zipline adventure passes to an overnight stay at Mohonk Mountain House. Travel greener, eat local. Come to the expo on April 30th. Get your tickets now at www.escapemaker.com. The following message has been brought to you by Fairway Market. What's the buzz about honey? Well, those busy little bees are up to something, and it is delicious. The Fairway label honey is superb. Fairway only hires worker bees that are the best at what they do. This makes for a great tasting, high quality honey at an amazing value with the Fairway stamp of approval. And on top of being delicious, honey is a great substitute for other sweeteners and can even benefit your health. This includes better energy, respiratory improvements, and balanced blood sugar levels. It's a no-brainer. Get your Fairway honey today.